It is Wednesday, April 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, China announces $50 billion in retaliatory tariffs on United States goods. We get analysis on the impact on the relationship between the two countries.
We're quite integrated with each other. You know, we might end up eventually moving back in a more of a Cold War situation where we disengage.
Wednesday marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. and singer Meghan Trainor has a new single and soon will have a new husband. It's all ahead. China announced Wednesday it plans to impose tariffs on $50 billion worth of U.S. goods in response to a similar package announced by the United States. The Chinese measures would boost tariffs by 25% on 106 U.S. products, including soybeans, aircraft, and cars. China's Commerce Ministry responded with its own measures less than 11 hours after the U.S. issued a proposed list of Chinese goods. Last month, U.S. President Donald Trump announced his intention to impose $50 billion in increased tariffs on Chinese products. On Tuesday, the U.S. Trade Representative released a proposed list of 1,300 goods, including aerospace, medical, and information technology products. The prospect of a trade war between the world's two largest economies has worried stock market investors. U.S. markets opened sharply lower Wednesday. Howard J. Schatz is a senior economist at the RAND Corporation and specializes in international economics and national security. He spoke with International Edition's Lori London.
Extremely risky what the Trump administration is doing. It could backfire. It could end up working out. We really just don't know. This is uncharted water for just about all of us.
Well, if it did backfire, what would happen? What would we see? What would it look like?
If what the Trump administration does backfires, then what we will see is the continual escalation on the economic front between the U.S. and China. We will see less trade and investment flows. That will affect jobs. That'll likely lead to higher prices for certain types of goods. Financial markets will probably continue their downward trajectory, and we will have to reassess whether or not we want the type of overall trade investment relationship with China that we currently have. We're quite integrated with each other. You know, we might end up eventually moving back in a more of a Cold War situation where we disengage, but that'd be really at the far extreme. We are still very far from that type of outcome.
The Trump administration has been saying that they're just trying to level the playing field, that it hasn't been fair. Are those statements accurate?
I think the Trump administration's analysis of Chinese trade and industrial policy is accurate. There's a Washington consensus that China plays unfair. I think the question is the Trump administration's approach to trying to resolve that imbalance the best way to go? Their argument is that we've tried the WTO and a bunch of other methods, and we now need to throw out the old playbook and bring in a new one. It certainly may work, but it's quite risky because the Chinese aren't just rolling over.
Are we in a full-blown trade war or heading toward a trade war?
Salvos of a trade war. Certainly, both sides are also signaling that they're interested in negotiating, and there is some element of discussions that they're carrying on, and it's possible at some point that the Trump administration and Beijing could find common ground to bring this to a close. But if there's anything we know about, these are the opening politics in Washington these days. It's unpredictability.
What kind of long-term repercussions could all of this have for the economy here and around the world?
Well, it's really hard to say. It could, you know, if the U.S. and China find a way to address these concerns and China brings their industrial policy machine back closer in line with the WTO, it could actually be a spur to salvage the WTO and the multilateral trading system. On the other hand, if they continue to escalate, it could break that system. And then we'd be in a more Hobbesian world of might makes right, and that would be worse off for us, the Chinese, and everybody else.
We're in the midst of potentially trying to have a breakthrough with North Korea, and I know China plays a vital role in that. Could all of this somehow damage the effort?
I think China has very clear interests with regard to the Korean Peninsula. They do not want war. They want peace, most of all. They want stability. And they would like an improvement in the overall relationship between North Korea and the U.S. as well. Those are interests that are there regardless of the U.S.-China trade relationship. China has already gone pretty far to try and push North Korea to talk to the United States by complying with U.N. sanctions. It's possible that if the U.S. and China get in a very bitter trade war, that China's approach at the tactical level with North Korea might adjust somewhat. I think their overall strategic interests aren't going to. We obviously have to pay attention to both at the same time, but I think there's also some level of independence between where the two are going.
Howard J. Schott, senior economist at the RAND Corporation. He was speaking with International Edition's Laurie London. Well, joining me on the line is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, hello, Sarah. And I know a little bit later in the program, you're going to be taking a look at what is a very somber anniversary today. Of course, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and really, I mean, an individual who, you know, really helped, I think, change the United States and change the world, arguably, not only in his life, but after his life as well. So many, many people are talking about that on social media, reflecting where we are now in terms of, you know, racial relations, social justice, that kind of thing. Not so much debate, but just sort of, you know, I guess, quiet observation. So that's taking up a lot of space today. But, you know, every now and then I like to stump you a little bit. I'll ask you a question, which I'm going to ask right now. Do you know what today is, Sarah?
Other than the King anniversary, no, I don't.
Well, today is apparently, and I don't know how this got past us, National Hug a News Person Day. And a lot of people, believe it or not, are talking about this in a somewhat comical but also somewhat serious way. Here's Dan Rather, of course, longtime newsman himself. I hear it's National Hug a News Person Day. While I appreciate a good hug as much as the next person, may I suggest hashtag buy a subscription day and support your favorite hardworking journalists for an entire year. Here's a pal of mine who works at the Washington Post, Dan Zak. He just has one quick comment: don't touch me. That's sort of his cup of comedy. A lot of people sending out hugs, I guess, to various people on Twitter, news people on Twitter. Here's somebody sending out, you know, hugs to Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes, Joanne Reed, Nicole Wallace, et cetera, et cetera. So you're seeing a lot of that. And here's Christopher Zullo. News isn't fake just because it's critical of you. Alternative facts are not real unless supported by evidence. Fox News is the fake news that you seek. Shut it off. Ask public businesses to switch the channel. We must fight this propaganda of fear. And finally, one last comment. Ending on a humorous note, somebody, Ethan Online, just tweets out, and here come the sexual harassment lawsuits.
Oh, no.
Hashtag National Hug a News Person Day. So, you know, people having some fun with it, but also I think, you know, basically saying, look, you know, some of the news industry is struggling, especially print. And so, if, you know, people appreciate news or particular journalists, you know, go out and support them, go out and buy a subscription, that kind of thing.
All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The U.S. and three of its allies vow to hold accountable those responsible for a gas attack in Syria. The chief of NATO is visiting U.S. military bases. The CEO of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, will testify before a congressional committee. And London's murder rate soars above New York amid gang violence. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Could classic tools like a net and harpoon help solve the growing problem of space junk? A SpaceX Dragon cargo ship containing supplies and several experiments has been sent up to the International Space Station. Among the experiments includes the Remove Debris Satellite. The satellite will deploy a couple of tiny CubeSats that will serve as test targets. Then a net will be fired at the targets to see how effective it would be to capture junk in space. Next, after a plate that substitutes as a satellite panel is deployed, a harpoon will be launched to see if it can snag and retrieve the floating space junk. The experiment will also test vision-based rendezvous navigation technology that is hoped will help target space debris. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, police say the shooter at YouTube headquarters held a grievance against that company. We'll have more. It has been 50 years since 39-year-old American civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was gunned down while standing on a balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, on April 4, 1968. It was one of a number of tragic events that tumultuous year. King was in Memphis to support striking sanitation workers. His last speech, delivered without notes, came the night before at the city's Mason Temple Church of God in Christ, where King delivered his famous mountaintop remarks.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Two of King's children attended a special service for their father at the same Memphis church Tuesday night that included video appearances by former Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. University of Virginia political science professor Larry Sabato tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, it's hard to imagine how the civil rights movement could have been as successful as it was without Dr. Martin Luther King.
He was able to communicate not just with African Americans, his base, but also with whites, who, after all, at that time, were well over 85% of the population. So if there was really going to be change and lasting change, at least legally, the movement needed somebody like King, and they found a wonderful speaker and a great leader in Martin Luther King.
What brought him to the forefront compared to many other eloquent speakers?
Partly it was that his message was broad-based, but also partly the circumstances of history. He came on the scene at just the right moment when Washington was changing, when Congresses and administrations were willing to tackle the tough issue that had eluded all in American government since the end of the Civil War. And it was really that combination, which is often true in history. It's a combination of circumstances, luck, and ability.
It was tragic for a man whose life was cut short as his was, a man who was preaching peace and unity and understanding, being cut down by violence.
Yes, it was a horrible irony. And it also signaled to us, I think, around the world, that America was in for a very tough year. But, you know, Dr. King was the last person you would have expected to be assassinated in the civil rights movement because he consistently preached nonviolence and civil disobedience that was peaceful. Most of his contemporaries, certainly by the mid to late 60s in the civil rights movement, were more inclined to tolerate violent acts. They felt that violence was probably needed to move the white majority toward equality. But Dr. King never gave up hope that nonviolence could be the way. He certainly at times was discouraged. Who couldn't be in the 1960s in civil rights or a lot of other fields? But he helped to pull the movement and to pull American society towards equality that was based on peaceful protest rather than violent protest. Unfortunately, after his death, there was a long spasm of violence that was as intense as anything America's ever experienced.
Larry Sabato said King's legacy is one of nonviolence and peaceful civil disobedience to an unjust order that remains an inspiration to America and the world. U.S. authorities said a woman who opened fire at the YouTube headquarters near San Francisco, wounding three before killing herself, had a long-running grievance against the video-sharing company. Investigators said the shooter, 39-year-old Nassim Najafi Aghdam of San Diego, a vegan-themed content provider, had raged against YouTube on her personal website for what she viewed as censorship of her videos. Her father said she had complained that YouTube had stopped paying her for videos she had posted on the platform. Even with her grievances against the video-sharing website, police said they do not believe she targeted anyone in particular on Tuesday when she opened fire at a time when many workers were eating lunch, some of them outside the headquarters. San Bruno Police Chief Ed Barberini said officers rushed to the YouTube campus after receiving numerous emergency calls.
Currently, there is no evidence linking Aghdam to any individuals at the scene at the time of this incident. A Smith & Wesson 9mm semi-automatic handgun registered to the suspect was recovered at the scene. Investigators also learned that the suspect went to a local gun range yesterday morning prior to visiting YouTube. The processing of the crime scene has been concluded up there on Cherry Avenue. San Bruno investigators, with the assistance of ATF, are in the process of executing search warrants at two residences in Southern California believed to be associated with our suspect. The suspect is believed to have parked her vehicle to the rear of a neighboring business and accessed the campus via a parking garage. The suspect's vehicle has been secured and is expected to be processed over the course of the next few days. Investigators will also be working to gain access to and review all social media related posts associated with the suspect in an effort to further comprehend the motive for this crime. At this point in the investigation, it is believed that the suspect was upset with policies and practices of YouTube. This appears to be the motive of this for this incident.
Aghdam's body was found in the building. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. A singer born on the Massachusetts island of Nantucket has a new single and a wedding on the horizon. VOA's Border Crossing host Larry London joins me with the details.
Today, we're taking you back to that 50s and 60s retro sound that has been made very popular by the style of Meghan Trainor. Meghan Trainor's back. It's been a few years. She's gone through some different challenges in her career. She had throat surgery. She had to cancel her tour for the second time and rest her vocal cords. So that's been an issue that's bothered her. But she's back now, and she's looking great. She's been working out and exercising, trimmed down, looking fantastic, getting ready for her upcoming wedding to actor Daryl Sabara. He was in Spy Kids, and he's had some other film roles. And the two of them got engaged on her birthday, her 24th birthday in December. So the wedding is coming up sometime this year. She's all excited about that. She's got new music out, which we're going to check out right now. And I'll tell you more about Meghan Trainor after we listen to the new song, No Excuses.
What you sipping on? Always coming at me. Why you acting hard when you just a
think the retro music of the 50s and 60s is so popular?
Well, I think it's not necessarily that it's the retro sound. It's all in how it's presented and packaged. And it just so happens that Meghan Trainor, who came out in 2016 with All About the Bass and won the Breakthrough Artist of the Year Grammy Award that year for All About the Bass, and she's had These Lips Are Movin' and quite a few other songs that are all in that sound. It's just that she's kind of captured the sound better than a lot of other people who have tried as well. So I'm not really sure why, but she seems to have the chemistry, the ingredients to be successful. She started off way back when she was about 15 or 16 as a songwriter. She never saw herself as a singer or a pop idol. She always liked writing music, and one day L.A. Reid said to her, "I want to make you a singing star. Why aren't you singing your songs?" And she said, "Well, look at me. I'm not a pop material person." He said, "Yes, you are." And so she recorded her debut album called Tidal in 2015, and as I mentioned, All About That Bass soared up to the top of the charts, and she got all kinds of awards, a couple of Billboard awards. She was, you know, the hottest thing in music for a couple of years, 2015, 2016. She dropped out of sight for the last year or two, as I mentioned earlier. Now she's back, and we're looking forward to what will be her ultimately third album when it comes out, hopefully sometime this year. But she's got a lot on her plate, planning a wedding and doing the other things she's been doing. She's been endorsing products on TV. Very talented young lady from Massachusetts, and I'm very happy to see all the success that she's been getting. She's a great songwriter. She's written for many acts in country music and in pop music, and it's about time she's been noted for what she does best, and that is write and sing her own songs.
All right, thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossing. That is our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
April 4th is the United Nations International Day for Mine Awareness and Assistance in Mine Action. The occasion provides an opportunity for the world to reflect on both the progress made and the challenges that remain in clearing landmines and unexploded ordnance, which still endanger civilians in more than 60 states and other areas. The United States is working closely with partners worldwide to address this serious humanitarian challenge, which puts innocent people, including many children, at risk. The United States is the world's single largest financial supporter of efforts to address humanitarian hazards from landmines and unexploded ordnance in post-conflict countries, and to reduce the availability of excess, loosely secured, or otherwise at-risk weapons and munitions. Since 1993, the United States has invested more than $2.9 billion for the securing and safe disposal of excess small arms, light weapons, and munitions, as well as the safe clearance of landmines and explosive remnants of war in more than 100 countries. The United States has funded programs worldwide aimed at reducing at-risk weapons and munitions and at improving stockpile security. The goal is to prevent diversion of arms to terrorists and other destabilizing actors. Through the Conventional Weapons Destruction Program, the U.S. government has collaborated with partner nations and international organizations since 2003 to destroy more than 39,000 excess or poorly secured man-portable air defense systems. Also known as MANPADs, these are shoulder-fired missiles that, in the hands of terrorists or insurgents, pose a serious potential threat to global aviation. Proactive community outreach through our mine risk education programs has prevented countless injuries. At the same time, U.S.-funded survivor assistance has provided essential medical and rehabilitation services to more than 250,000 people injured by landmines and unexploded ordnance. Working in close cooperation with the Department of Defense and the U.S. Agency for International Development's Leahy War Victims Fund, the Department of State has helped numerous countries to declare themselves mine-free. On this day of mine awareness, we urge other nations to join us in a robust international partnership with the shared goal of reducing the impact of landmines around the world. That was a-